Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
My name is John Merrill. I'm a lawyer in Ogletree's Greenville, South Carolina office. And today I'm going to be talking to you about getting back to work. This is going to be a high-level discussion. We could talk about this topic all day, but the firm likes to keep our podcast to 15 to 20 minutes. So I'm going to try to hit a handful of specific areas of concern to give you some food for thought. First, let me talk about a few resources that I think you'll find really helpful. This is being taped on Wednesday, April 22nd in the afternoon. And as we all know, we're going to be talking a little bit about COVID-19, and this stuff changes literally every hour. So there may be some new guidance from the CDC, the World Health Organization, the DOL, your state, your city, or some other governing body by the time you listen to this. I'd encourage you to check ogletree.com as regularly as you can to get frequent updates on this topic because it is ever-changing. Now, if you go to ogletree.com, and that's O-G-L-E-T-R-E-E.com, you'll see in the top right-hand corner a link that says COVID-19 Resource Center. Follow that link and you'll see all our latest blog posts, and there are usually multiple posts a day, as well as several categories for different types of guidance. One that I think is particularly useful is a chart we have that shows closure and screening orders. If you click on that COVID-19 Resource Center link and then click on the blue button that says closure/screening orders, it takes you to two really lengthy and frequently updated charts. One of them shows the status of closing orders in states and major municipalities. And this will be obviously really important to you as you determine where you're able to return employees to work. Now, there's also another chart on that page that shows the states and localities that have certain screening orders in place. So these are state and local orders that address face coverings or require certain employee screening steps be taken. So obviously, it's going to be important to check that before you resume operations to see if there's an order in place that's going to require you to take certain screening steps that otherwise you might not take. Finally, and I'll talk some more about this at the end of our podcast, but Ogletree's just released our Return to Work Guide. It's this extremely robust, detailed guide to resuming operations. The guide itself is about 50 pages long, but it also contains, on top of that, about 20 plus templates, checklists, flowcharts, surveys that are all extremely helpful in helping you navigate all the potential employment law issues that are going to come up when you get ready to resume operations or when you're bringing employees back into the workplace. Okay, so as I said, we could talk for 8 hours about legal issues associated with resuming operations, but we don't have that much time. I want to talk about just a few areas where you need to think carefully about the legal implications of returning employees to work. First of all, when I'm talking about returning to work, that can take several different forms. You could be bringing furloughed employees back to work. You could be bringing laid off employees back to work. Or you could be bringing employees who are working from home back into the workplace. Or you might be looking at restoring furloughed or laid off employees to full duty, but allowing them to work from home. All these permutations of return to work have their own pitfalls, so it's hard to give some one-size-fits-all guidance on returning to work, especially in a short podcast, but we're going to do our best to hit some common issues, again, at a really high level. The first thing I will observe is that if you're resuming operations and not every employee is going to be returned to work, you need to think hard on the front end about who gets the opportunity to come back. It's worth taking your time to assess your business, figure out your current business conditions, your current demand. What roles must you have if you're going to resume operations? And document that, document the number of employees you need to return to resume operations at whatever level you're going to be resuming operations. Document the skills you need, and based on those factors, figure out the selection criteria you're going to use in deciding who will be offered the opportunity to return. You know, I envision that many employers, while we would love to go back to the way things were, you might have to, at least in the short term, resume operations with less than your full employee complement, with fewer than your full workforce. So figuring out what exactly you need and what selection criteria you will use in determining who particularly you're going to bring back is going to be very important. Now, wherever possible, it's great to lean towards objective criteria instead of subjective criteria. It's just easier to defend when you're, if your decision to return one person over another comes under scrutiny. So certifications, attendance, and objective measurements of productivity are a little bit easier to defend than subjective criteria like leadership qualities or communication skills or attitude. The reason this is important is that a decision to bring some but not all employees back to work from furlough or layoff could be subject to scrutiny, particularly if it has an adverse impact on members of a protected class. So, in other words, if your decision-making process, even if it's based on good factors, if it has a disproportionate negative impact on a protected class of employees, that can create some serious legal concerns. So in addition to making the business case on the front end for why you're going to return the employees you are, it's a good idea to select appropriate decision makers, ideally a diverse team of decision makers, and train them so that they understand what the potential legal pitfalls are and what factors they need to focus on when determining who gets to come back and who stays laid off or furloughed. Once you've made those tentative initial decisions on who comes back, you can also run a statistical analysis to ensure that your decisions are not having a disproportionate impact on the members of a protected class. Let's go to the next step. Now, assuming you've made the decision on who comes back, you've run the numbers, and you've determined it's not going to have an adverse impact on any protected class, I think it's a very good idea to draft a notice to employees before returning them to work. And make sure that you have proof that you sent them that notice. Having a record that you've asked the employee to return to work will be useful if, for example, the employee refuses to come to work out of safety concerns and wants to continue seeking unemployment benefits, or if the employee later tries to bring some kind of employment claim against you. It's important that you, in this communication, that you inform the employee of the steps you've taken to ensure workplace safety. Now, I mentioned unemployment a minute ago. Generally, if an employee refuses an opportunity to resume work, the employee will be unable to continue receiving unemployment. And I know that's a concern for a lot of employers who worry that with this enhanced $600 CARES Act benefit, that employees are going to be incentivized to stay home from work and not come back. And generally, unemployment is for employees who are unemployed through no fault of their own, meaning that if you offer them the opportunity to come back and they refuse it, they're no longer eligible for unemployment. With that said, if an employee has a good faith basis for believing that returning to work is going to present a risk to their safety, most states will allow them to continue collecting unemployment. So creating a record that you have offered the employee to the opportunity to come back and that you've taken numerous appropriate steps to ensure their safety in the workplace will help you establish that the employee does not have a good faith basis for refusing to return to work. Additionally, it's just good for employee relations. People are going to be scared to come back to work. The more you can do to inform them of the steps you've taken to provide them with a safe place to work, the better off you'll be from an employee relations standpoint. When we talk about the types of steps that might be appropriate to create that safe workplace, there are a few things to think about. Now, more than anything else we're going to talk about, there's no one-size-fits-all approach here. It's going to be highly specific to your workplace and to your industry. If you're a fast food restaurant, it's going to look different than if you're a manufacturer or a car dealership or a grocery store. With that said, some sort of universal concerns that you ought to think about are how you're going to ensure social distancing, how you're going to keep the workplace clean and disinfected, how you're going to secure adequate supplies of, you know, soap, disinfectant, hand sanitizer, maybe even non-medical masks, among many other supplies, and how you're going to screen people and how you're going to handle people who are sick or symptomatic at work. So the first thing I mentioned, I think, is social distancing. And that's more than just making sure everybody stays 6 feet apart. I think you ought to consider changing your meeting protocols. You ever hear the old phrase, you'd have a meeting and somebody would say at the end, this entire meeting could have been an email. Well, there are lots of meetings that could be emails or could be Zoom meetings or could be WebEx meetings. And that's certainly appropriate at this time. We've all gotten used to that, right? So shifting as many meetings as possible to Zoom or WebEx, ensuring that any in-person meetings, meetings that absolutely have to happen in person, that you've got adequate social distancing, adequate ventilation, adequate cleaning protocols for any meeting room, all that's extremely important. You might even consider, you know, installing physical dividers in the workplace. If that's appropriate to a lot of maybe manufacturing companies, that might be a possibility, and other types of companies. There are numerous different ways to achieve social distancing. It's more than just saying stay 6 feet apart. There are other things you ought to consider. Another component is screening employees before they come back into the workplace. Now, if you'd asked me two and a half months ago, I would have told you you can't take somebody's temperature. You can't ask them questions about symptoms. These are ADA regulated medical inquiries that have to be job related, consistent with business necessity. Well, in a pandemic, the rules are a little different, and the EEOC has issued special pandemic guidance on an employer's ability to make certain medical inquiries that would otherwise be improper under the ADA, including temperature checks. So having a procedure in place for that, having protocols in place, understanding the different types of thermometers that can be used for that purpose, and also having some protocols in place so that it's done in a private manner and so that the results of it are kept confidential. The results of any temperature screens or symptom screens of the like, all that is very important. You should also consider putting a procedure in place for how you're going to handle people who are actually sick or symptomatic or who have a known exposure. One thing I would note is that just 5 days ago, the CDC updated its guidance relating to symptoms of COVID-19. Previous CDC materials focused on fever, cough, shortness of breath, but noted that additional symptoms might also be out there that would be indicative of COVID-19. Well, the CDC has now clarified that additional symptoms might include chills, repeated shaking with chills, muscle pain, headache, sore throat, and new loss of taste or smell. So having a plan to determine what you're going to do when you have an employee with one of those symptoms in the workplace is obviously very important. And I think another important step is to train your employees on what they can do to protect themselves. Making sure they understand what you're doing is important, but they also need to understand what they can do. They need to understand what social distancing really means, what effective hand washing is. We'd like to think that everybody knows that at this point because we've been harping on the 20 seconds for so long, but making sure they understand that, making sure they understand they don't need to be using each other's phones or using each other's computers, and making sure they know what effective disinfection procedures look like from their perspective. Just educate them on how they can protect themselves, how they can protect each other, how they can protect your customers. And because we don't have much time, I want to talk about one more thing, which is making sure you have appropriate policies in place. You know, if you're going to allow employees to work from home on an ongoing basis and you don't already have a work from home policy, now is the time to adopt one. You can spell out in the policies which type of positions are appropriate for work from home. You can create an approval process for work from home. You can put rules in place about how employees are going to track their time, how employees are going to protect your confidential information, ensure cybersecurity from home. There are a lot of different things that go into an effective work from home policy. And if you don't have one yet, now is the time to do it. One consideration that we obviously hope is not the case, but could very well be the case, is there could be another wave. We could be returning to the workplace and there could be another wave of social distancing down the road. In which case, it'd be good to have that work from home policy in place now and think about these issues now so you're ready to address them if that happens. If you got sick leave policies or your attendance policies, you might consider making them more flexible, because while we would love to think that life is going to go back to normal in the short term, we're not there yet. people are still going to have childcare obligations that they didn't have before. They're still going to have family care obligations that are different from what they had before. And I think it's important that our policies acknowledge that reality. So one thing I would recommend is go through your handbook and make sure that the policies you've got in place now are adequate to deal with the current moment. If you're an employer with fewer than 500 employees, you're subject to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, and therefore you probably ought to have some policies in place for employees who want to take emergency family medical leave or emergency paid sick leave under that law. And just thinking about your general policies and how they would apply to the world we are currently living in. What workplace safety policies do you have in place? Do you have a good policy on disability accommodation? Because while COVID-19 itself may not qualify as a disability because it's transitory in nature, it can exacerbate existing disabilities, creating a need for accommodation. It could also possibly leave employees who get infected and who recover with disabilities that they didn't have before that need to be accommodated. So do you have that disability accommodation policy in place, and are your HR people prepared to deal with those accommodation requests? Do you have complaint reporting mechanisms that employees can use if they got concerns about safety or concerns about how they're being treated by their coworkers or the company? All very important to have. Those are just a few of the many policies that I think it's important to look at and to make sure that you have in place. I think it's worth your while just to go through your handbook, go through your policies, see what no longer works and what else you need in order to resume operations. All right, so this really just scratches the surface. Additionally, as I mentioned, I want to say a couple words about our return to work guide. It was put together with contributions by around 30 lawyers. Somebody did the math and figured out 600 plus years of experience among those lawyers who worked on the guide. It took hundreds of hours to put together. And the guide itself is about 50 pages long. It's got 20 plus templates, checklists, surveys, and flowcharts that I think you'd find extremely useful. Some of the attachments alone are extremely robust. For example, we've got an attachment that is a guide on temperature screening and other forms of screening in the workplace. And that attachment alone is 36 pages with 5 forms for employers to use. The flat fee for the guide with the attachments is $2,500 for new clients. It's $1,950 for existing clients. That also includes 30 minutes of attorney consultation time regarding the guide. We've got a team of lawyers who are going to be consulting with clients about the guide itself to answer your questions about the guide. Anyone who's interested can contact the Ogletree lawyer they normally work with, or you can contact me. Thanks for joining me today. I hope this has been helpful, and I wish you the best. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll get through this together.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.